And the second day, we worked a little bit on just a simple thing called the apostolic greeting, as a welcome, as an introduction to the community, as a sign of who's all out there in the congregation and how we're to be greeted. And with that, I'm going to jump now from that welcoming word at the apostolic greeting all the way to the time of the offering. But I thought, again, I'd clarify just briefly that idea of empire, and that the congregation, the community of Christ, is in a sense, as we move out of the worship and we begin our worship of everyday life out in our communities, out in our families, who we are and how we live our lives and what this redeemed community and this saving community is all about really becomes a threat to the way the world is. And one of the ways I wanted to highlight that was just a brief piece here. This is from Mysteries of Christ. It's in the bookstore.
Sold out.
Huh, never mind. But if they get some more in, or if you're home, this is a good one, along with many of Capon's books. Some good stuff. But a little piece that I would just read toward the beginning of his book. He's speaking to a woman who has had who has been involved in an affair, and kind of is wondering. And she has made this bargain with God about an accident her daughter was in, and this bargain: if only she would be, if she would get better, I would get out of this affair. And so this is one of the pieces that I'd like to read from. "Well," says Capon, "you remember Caligula, a real nasty piece of work. Arrogant, cruel, and very busy working himself up to being a god while he's still alive. Anyways, when Caligula, who is an emperor of Rome, is supposedly sick to death, one of the senators makes an extravagant vow to the gods. 'My life for Caesar's, if he is spared,' he says. Caligula, of course, gets better. And when he meets the senator after his recovery, he first expresses admiration for the vow, but then he says, 'Isn't there something wrong with this situation, though? If you offered your life for mine, we shouldn't both be here, should we?' And he sends the senator off under guard to make sure he makes good on his vow by opening a vein. Think about that a little." And he says to the woman, "You made a vow to finish off your lover if your daughter was spared, and now you want to know if you have to deliver on the promise. I said the answer depended on what kind of God you made that vow to. There's no question, of course, that if you believed in a Roman-style God, or in almost any God other than the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, all of them rather nasty pieces of work, just like Caligula, the answer would be yes, deliver or be damned. But is that the kind of God you believe in? I'd like to say no." One of the things about empire is that the empire is exactly Caligula. It's exactly a world that wants retribution. It's exactly a world that wants a tit for a tat, an eye for an eye, that kind of thing. But the community of Christ that we are all about, the community of Christ in which we are a part, is a very different kind of way of being a community. And so when we're a threat to empire, we're a threat to the very fabric of what our world's all about. I use the words principalities and powers in the last two sessions to kind of describe who this empire is and that we're a part of it. We're ever much a part of it as everything else. I think it was Bob Ekblad last night who said, it was Michael Moeller who mentioned about the Holden sweatshirts. And we were talking about immigration and how the Holden sweatshirts were made in China and how we're all pretty much tied into this vast network of cheap labor. And, you know, you can't get away from that. We're all tied into this idea of empire. Well, with today's session, the essence, if you wanted to talk about what I'd like to do today, is this time of offering is a time in which we're building character. And how I'd like to say that is simply that when we have children's lesson, and that's going to be the piece I'm going to focus on today, when children are a part of our congregation on a Sunday morning worship, I'm pretty much become an advocate of kids' lessons in the service. I used to not. I used to not do children's lessons. We didn't have them in our congregation. But more and more, it's become a real solid building point to how I see Christian formation for the kids, but also for the adults. Because I think it's in that moment where you've got the whole gathered community, and we're looking at and we're all experiencing exactly who we are. It's kind of like when we have to say to our kids, yeah, Bobby's going to go do that, but this is who we are, and this is how we live, and this is how we move through the day, and this is what's important to us. So the children's lesson, which within the context of a liturgy, within the context of a feast, is a time for us to share with our children who we are. So that the children then, from what I've always seen, that they even become ones who, in the family life outside the liturgy, begin to call their own parents into accountability at times by just little things that they've snipped in the worship that have been times where everything's been totally focused on them. One story to give you an example. Probably one of the toughest things I've done in the last, I'd say, 6 months. My daughter goes to an all-girls school, and one of the good things about that has been she's gotten a real strong character about who she is in her space. She's accelerating herself in math and science beyond what she'd done before. But one of the things she came up to us a couple times and said was she wanted to take Taekwondo. It's martial art where you use a lot of kicking. And I just turned it off and wouldn't even listen to her, really. And then she kept coming back to us. It's kind of like kept knocking at the door. She wanted to take Taekwondo. She wanted to take Taekwondo. And finally, we said yes to that because one of her arguments was, you know, boys do lots of physical things. They get to do these sports where they get to use their whole bodies, and she wanted to be able to master this whole body thing. So we said, okay. Well, she's moving along. She's a purple belt now, and she's dating a guy who is just a master at his age in Taekwondo. He's fourth degree black belt. He really knows his stuff. And they're not just—he's not just teaching her anymore. They've been dating, and it's been kind of an interesting thing going on. And in conversations that kids have when they're dating, and they talk about all kinds of stuff. And one of the things that this friend told her was that how humiliated he would be if he ever was smacked in the face by a woman. You know, like an insult, that kind of smack. And I don't know what the context for that was, but he had just shared that with her. Now, how did I find out about that? It got to be prom time this last year. And they both go to separate schools. And they've been seeing each other. And really, the expectation was in our household that they would probably go to the prom together. Well, what happened was he had not been seeing any other girl, and he asked another girl to the prom. And so on one level, my daughter was quite devastated. On another level, she came to us, and she was very confused because our family's Anglo, and he comes from an African-American family. And he just happened to invite another African-American girl to go to the prom with him. And she said, I don't even think he knows her that well. Why didn't he ask me? And I came in the room one night in the conversation in which she was saying she can't wait to see him because she's going to smack him across the face. And I had a hard time. And her and my wife were talking about this thing. And one of the things at that point we kind of tried to help her see was, well, yeah, you heard him say that that would humiliate him, that that would be the most humiliating thing that could ever happen to him. But just having to say, that's not what we do. We don't humiliate other people. We don't beat other people. There are other ways to express our anger and our fear and our sadness than to do it in a way that is a violent attack on another person. That's who we are. And so the way I see children's lessons in this congregation is to help our kids get a little more clear of a picture of who we are. And so that's really kind of the essence of of what, where I'm going to be going today. One assumption that I'm making, and it goes along, I think, with the week, is that the assumption is that every Sunday we have Eucharistic liturgy. I talked to one of the men in the village the other day. And after one of the sessions, he told me a little bit about his congregation. He said they've got 6,000 people in their congregation. They have Eucharist every Sunday, but it's at certain services, and some there's not a participation with the Eucharist. Well, I'm assuming that we share the Eucharist. We're a part of the feast every week. And so where I'm placing the children's lesson really plays into the idea that the Eucharist is going to be the main liturgy in the congregation on a Sunday. And in some ways, I don't think it matters how big the congregation is and how many programs you have for kids. I would still suggest almost that some kind of children's lesson play a part in the feast, the Eucharistic liturgy, that it's an integral part of who we are and where we're going. Maybe just want to stop for a second and ask you a little bit about your congregations. Do you have lessons within the service that are children's lessons? If you do, when do you have them? If you do other things with children in the primary liturgy, in the Eucharistic liturgy, what do you do? Is there any comment about that? And what is the content? And do you like them or don't you like them? And what would you like to see better with them? But do you have children's lessons in the congregations in which you attend? Where do they put them?
At the front.
At the very beginning?
At the very beginning.
Okay.
And of course they do special things with the children in the church. They have their own choir. Mm-hmm. They have their own, of course we have a day school, and we encourage those students in that church or in that care center to participate in chapel daily,
mm-hmm.
and then of course on Friday they have a review of the week's activity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a theme of the school during the week. And then on Friday, we review that, what they supposedly learned the rest of the week.
So then on Sunday mornings, when you focus on the kids, it's right at the beginning of the service?
Yes.
Okay. Is this like once everybody's seated and you've sung a hymn already, or is this just even before that?
Except we've gone through the liturgy, completed the liturgy, and had probably two hymns.
Okay.
That we do the children's sermon.
Okay. Others?
Between the second lesson and the gospel, I don't know why.
Okay. Another one of the lessons. Yeah, most often that's what that's where I hear most of them being placed, is right around the times of the readings of the lessons, next to the other sermon. Yeah.
We don't have one every week at Leavenworth. We did have one every week at Chelan when I served the interim there this year. And I had it after the gospel and tried to have a way to express the theme of the day or the text or the liturgy or the season of the year or something. And then we sang the hymn and then we had the sermon for the day, which I hope included the kids, but was not kind of aimed at the kids. I wasn't sitting down with them, sitting around me in the front in a very small parish.
Mm-hmm.
The more visual they were, the more they connected. If we moved the wise men from the back toward the altar or the manger, that had more interest than my just talking.
Yep.
They could find them somewhere in the church. I worked harder on that than my other sermon.
Mm-hmm. But there's that is that tie to the lesson,
yeah,
lessons or seasons.
I tried to, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
When we've only been doing Sunday morning worship for about 2 years, and we have not yet incorporated a children's sermon, and one of my anxieties and why I'm here is that when I was just a campus pastor and I would preach around different places, they would have children's sermons. And one thing I noticed in almost any church, how somewhat tuned in they were during that time, but how they were tuned out the rest of the time. Like,
the kids?
Like,
or the adults?
No, the kids.
Well, well the kids, yes, the adults were probably tuned out except for the children's sermon too. But it was the one that it almost said to the kids that this is your time, the rest of the time you don't have to pay attention. You know, and so we're trying to integrate intentionally music and songs, and one hymn, you know, one stanza here is children only, you know, that sort of thing.
Good.
But I'm struggling with it because I want the worship, I want the liturgy to be participatory for all people and not just tune in, tune out at appropriate times or inappropriate.
Yeah, and I hope we get to that a little bit too. Yeah.
I've also noticed along with what you're saying is that is church exit time. For the youngsters.
Well, sometimes. Yeah.
Oh, you mean once it's over?
Yeah. Once it's over, it's
Before the real sermon begins.
Okay. Yeah, Jeff.
I really like them, so don't misunderstand my comment. But I think part of the reason that there is some negative reaction is they tend too often to be very predictable.
Yes.
Walter Brueggemann has a now famous story, and it probably wasn't his, but he told it up here. That the preacher got up to tell the children's sermon. He said, "Today, boys and girls, I want to describe something. It's a little creature. It's furry. It has a big, bushy tail. It gathers nuts all summer and stores them for the winter. Does anybody know what the sermon's going to be about?" No answer. "Doesn't anybody know?" And one little boy says, "Well, it sounds for all the world like a squirrel, but the answer is probably Jesus."
That's it. I have down here squirrel/Jesus. That's it. And that's one of the things, you know, just in regard to in your own congregations, the content, you know, what is it? Many times it is. It's so predictable.
The kids know what they got.
Yeah. And yet, one of the important things in the children's lesson is how important it is to sometimes stress a thematic piece of who we are, which is there's going to be the repetition, but there can be repetition without there being the same answer all the time. Very much so. Others, any other comments about where they are in your congregation, whether you like them or not, content?
I realize I missed a piece of taking care of a child, but are you saying that you give the kids the answers, or you're listening to what the kids are telling you?
No, we were just, I was just right now, I'm just kind of fielding.
Do you have children's sermons?
Do you have children's sermons?
We have children's sermons, and I think the best ones are when they're open-ended and say, what do you think? And the kids have the most wonderful sense of the gospel to come back and share.
Where do you put yours? That's the other kind of question we're asking now.
Before the sermon.
Okay, all right.
Where is yours?
It's in the offering. The playtime of offering, and I'll get to kind of why, the why of that, but that's,
somewhat off the subject, but it made me remember a story when I was doing a children's sermon once. We just started a parish, and I was the first associate pastor they had, and so I was giving some children's sermons. Raised his hands, looked at the other pastor, looked at me, says, "Which one of you died on the cross?"
You get some strange questions when you're doing children's. I mean, God's house, the pastor speaking, you know, now there's two of you. This kid was confused, 4 year olds.
But on the other hand, they come through such gorgeous insights.
Yeah.
I mean, Eric's my teacher in life. I mean, we walk in the trip one Sunday and he says, "Mom, you didn't tell me it was a celebration day." And I says, "Well, who told you?" He says, "Well, look, it's red."
He's tuned in the liturgy.
Oh yeah.
Very much so. But one of the things I want to kind of move with today is just to spell out one model, just one model. We all seem to have models in regard to how children's lessons are used. Just one model that we use in regard to Eucharistic, the Eucharistic celebration and the use of children's lessons. And I think part of what I want to say today is that we kind of reverse the order. There are a lot of places that I've been to where the children are in at the beginning. All the children, no matter what age, they really don't even open up in maybe the nursery until they've come to a point where the children's lesson is taking place, and then they go out and there's some kind of school, or else they go to nursery or do something. A lot of examples like that. We kind of turned that around a bit. In that nurseries open at the beginning of the service, Some people take their kids down to nursery, but we really encourage people, as many as possible, to keep the kids in the sanctuary, but to allow people the freedom to worship during that first half and to hear what would be called the regular sermon of the day without the real little ones there. And then the place where we call the kids in is when it's we've shared the prayer and we move into the peace. That's usually the sign for the nursery to be empty. We bring all the kids down during the sharing of the peace, and that's really their beginning time, where we have all of them in for the rest of the service. Even the babes in arms, those are the ones that are brought in for that peace. And this is a little bit of the reason for that. And one of the things I've noticed that I've got to appreciate is just how responsive the kids can be during the Eucharistic liturgy. Two little ones who sit in pretty much one of our front rows are more animated during the Eucharistic part of the liturgy than any other time. I'll be back behind the altar, I'll have my chasuble on, and they'll be following my gestures. It's one of the times, I think one of the things that they notice is I gesture a lot more during the Eucharistic liturgy. My hands are up, my hands are raised, I'll gesture to the community like this. And these two little kids, one's Jill Ann, she stands on top of the pew, and that's what she does. As soon as my hands go up, her hands go up. When I start to say some of the words, she starts to say some of the words, and then she answers. So the congregation gets to hear me chant, and then have her come in at the end almost on times. And it's just that hearing my voice as presider, but then to also hear the participation of the children in that portion of the service where we're talking about a feast, and we're talking about the foretaste of the feast to come. So in many ways, seeing the children, I think, in that part of the liturgy helps remind us of what in the world this is all about.
And your children commune then?
Pardon?
Your children commune here?
We'll get to that too. Yeah. Yes, they do, and no, they don't. But that all is a piece of this kind of setup of for the Eucharist. And one of the pieces we do with that, in fact, is we don't go all the way down to infants to commune. So part of the way we deal with the Eucharistic liturgy is it's based on the children's inquiry. So if I have, for example, a six-year-old who for the first time begins to ask his or her parent about communion, we kind of step in, and the parent and I do something with that child, and just to see, you know, what is the conversation about? And the way the conversation starts in our congregation, this was one of these radical things by a group of kids when we first came to Redeemer about 10 years ago. In Detroit, we used to give apple slices out to the kids. And when we came to Columbus, we weren't doing that. Redeemer wasn't giving anything to the kids, but there was kind of a hands-on blessing to all the kids who came out for communion. My daughter was, gosh, she must have been seven or eight, and she got talking to some of the other kids in the Sunday school class, and she told them about, we used to get apples in Detroit. And they, what do you mean you used to get? Well, we used to get apples. We go up front, we used to get apples. We don't get anything here. And so what happened was the next council meeting, the Sunday school teacher was great. She just picked up on this, and some of the kids had written a letter to the council saying, why don't we get apples during communion? We don't get anything during communion. And so the council, you know, everybody's just, I try to keep out of this one. Well, what do you think? And they just thought this was wonderful. And let me go into a little bit about what all that means in regard to the feast. The apple thing was an intentional thing I started in Detroit because I was at a congregation, it was the first congregation I had ever been in, first Lutheran congregation I ever joined. This grandfather, wonderful, wonderful picture of this grandfather taking his grandson up to the altar and just kind of showing him everything, and it was time for communion, and being a wonderful teacher, great patriarch, and they were kneeling down at the rail, and the pastor came by and gave communion to everybody, put his hand on this little boy's head and blessed him, and gave wine to everybody, And grandfather took the little boy and started turning him around, and they're coming down about four steps, and the kid, as loud as could be, "But I didn't get anything!" And I just thought, wow, you know, here you've got kids who don't deal well with these words we use anyhow. And here everybody got something, and he didn't get anything. He got a pastor's hand on his head, and he didn't get anything concrete, anything to hold on to. And so we started doing apple slices. The apple slices, how that works into the whole communion thing and the piece there is, during the time of communion, when the kids come up, one of the acolytes, it's his or her job to just have apples available. And we, in fact, I think they're, every week they're Granny Smith apples, because in Ohio those are ones you can get 12 months of the year, and they're always crisp and a little on the sour side, but they're always crisp and ready to go. And what we do then is I give each of the children an apple slice. And the way we tie it in to the whole Eucharistic liturgy and the whole baptismal life of the congregation is I also put a cross on the kid's forehead, and I say, "This is from your baptism." Or even if someone is baptized that day, I'll say, "Just remember, did you see me do that? Well, this is the cross from your baptism." To remind you, and the message is usually this simple, how important you are and how loved you are, or something on that line. And that's the truth, and no one can take that away from you, or something on that line. And I'll get down and I'll actually do one of our members in a wheelchair told me this once, that he appreciates when people don't talk down to him, but that when a person will actually, if he's in a wheelchair, will get down like this and get down on his level. So we try to do that with the kids, so that they're at the meal time, it's not adults get, kids get looked down at, but that we're down on their level, making it a more welcome experience. Now, how does that tie into Holy Communion? The kids will get apples from the time they can first start munching. And I'll ask the parent of the little ones up to, is it, should we give them an apple? Not yet, not today. There's always that first day. And as the kids eat the apples, have the apples, and they're going along, kids begin to notice that other people are getting other things. And when it for them becomes, huh, what's going on here? That's when we start to look at communion. That's meant anything from fifth grade, because that has always been our usual age for kids taking communion, has been fifth grade. And so some kids go all the way to fifth grade until they take Holy Communion for the first time. But a lot of the other kids are trickling all the way down to coming into first grade and beginning to ask some questions. And the thing I've noticed too is there has not, because the parents aren't brought into this process, it doesn't look as though they're all pressured at one age. One of the things I first caught the first year I was there was almost like, well, but he's taking communion. This wasn't the kids saying this. This was a parent saying, but their kid's taking communion. Their kid didn't want to take communion. So one of the ways then in this part of the liturgy for communion and in embracing the children in this meal was to use the apples until the children ask. So I've never had an infant, for example, or something, or a real young child want to take communion in place of the apple. They seem to be real satisfied with that, something positive, and the word that goes with it.
Any particular reason why the apple was chosen?
Pardon?
Why apples were chosen versus crackers?
They work better than bananas, and they work better. We've tried different fruits, actually, to tell you the truth, at the very beginning. And apples were just something that somebody could cut up. One apple can do the whole liturgy. You know, we can do, anybody who comes to the liturgy, we got one apple, it's enough. It seems to always be enough. And we can break them. And we've had to do that if we have a big crowd. We've taken them and actually broken the pieces in half. The acolyte keeps tabs on who's coming forward. But again, just so they have something to hold on to.
Some people want just the apple because it's much more tasty than the bread or the wine, and I don't want to get into communion, I just want the apple.
The kids?
Yeah.
I think for some kids, yeah, because they're there. I remember one boy didn't, he was asking all the questions about communion, but he was afraid to take the wine. because he'd tasted wine at home, and he didn't want any part of that. And that's why when we get to fifth grade, we have that's our standard class when all the kids begin to take communion. But yeah, I've had kids want to keep getting the apple and the blessing. The flip side of that is, and which is really an important part too, that and why this that I'm
questions help them to understand more what they've been doing. Just like a family has rituals, and the littlest ones don't understand it, but they're part of it, and later they learn more about what they've been doing. Is there some theological or biblical or some reason that you don't just commune them instead of giving them an apple?
No. No, I think the reason for the infants was in the, you know, one of those first statements that came out about 1978, there was a strong argument that infant communion was to be precluded in our tradition, which I disagreed with.
Yeah.
But yeah, outside of that, it's been mainly a step toward moving to younger and younger reception.
I find it's hard pressed to defend against the Orthodox or the infant communion. I guess the Eastern Orthodox even has a little kind of pablum on a yummy stick or something for real infants. So there's probably at some point a practical problem, but I'm not sure it's a theological problem.
And the newer documents is arguing against that. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Along that same line, I'd like to put this little thought in that since we travel quite a bit, we visit different churches, different denominations, and I have seen in one instance in the Episcopal Church where the father was communing his sons. They were both 2 or 3 year old toddlers, and the father took the wine and gave each one of his boys a sip of the wine, and then he set the little cup down, and then broke the wafer and gave half each one of his boys. But the father was communing his sons rather than the priest.
So the priest came by and communed the father, and then the father took what he had received and shared it with his kids.
Okay. So that's a little twist to this whole idea. I was just wondering, I often wondered whether that theology would work in our faith or not.
The only time we do anything like that is on Maundy Thursday. We have table communion, but that's where everybody in the table communes the next one in line, and often it's in family blocks, but not otherwise.
Our policy right now is third grade, or if the parents and the child would like it at an earlier or a later age, and most often it's earlier, so we have 4-year-olds on up communing, but leave it up to parental discretion, so to speak, in that sense.
Another part of this Eucharistic liturgy and putting the kids into this latter half of the service is the beginning of the Eucharistic liturgy begins with activity and motion. And a remembrance of who we are. It's the sharing of the peace. And so, one of the things that happens there is you've got all these adults, you've got everybody milling around, and you've got everybody greeting the kids in a very different way. It's not hi Jill, hi Sue, hi this. It's the peace of our Lord be with you. And the kids get to hear that word being shared by the people and get to be a part of that. Which I think, again, is just that turning things upside down, that this is how we greet one another. Again, this is who we are. This is what shapes how we interact with one another, this peace that binds us together. And so that's an important time for them to be there, to be a part of the interchange and to be a part of what's happening. Now, why the offering? I mean, well, why do we have the offering? I'll start with the reason that's deeper than the reason that most of us talked about at council, I think, at one time. For me, I see where we're offering this money, and we do a lot of offering. It's very easy for a lot of us to just send something in the plate and move it forward, and that's our offering for the day. And it's easy in some ways to see the kids from there. We at our church during the Sunday school, they collect food. And so a couple of the kids are right behind the ushers carrying their basket of food out to the front. We put it in front of the altar. And so it's always something being brought forward. But in regard to this whole, getting to the theme of the foretaste of the feast to come and what I'm talking about with a threat to the empire, during this time, in essence, what we are doing with the children's lesson is we are offering up our kids.
Pardon?
We're offering up our kids. This is a time of discipleship training, I guess, you know, that would be another way I'd kind of put it. It's a time when you've got the banquet being prepared. If the acolyte's doing the thing right on some Sundays, the acolyte will be back there setting the table while the children's lesson's going on or the assisting minister. That doesn't always work. But so one of the things that's happening is we've got the feast being prepared, the table's being set, and the kids are coming forward for this lesson. And it's the importance of it not being the squirrel and the Jesus thing is that the congregation sees that what's being taught there is something that's shaping the lives of those kids. And in a moment, I want to get into some of the areas of concentration for those children's lessons. So what's happening is we've got a radical character being built within the kids, within some simple stories. I just want to read a brief quote, because this is for, I really appreciate parents who take their kids by the hand and bring them up, because some of the kids are small enough where the parents literally walk them, and this is for me this is very touching. They walk the kids up to the front if they're too small to go by themselves or they're too scared, and they sit the kids on their lap and are a part of the children's lesson. And why I'm so touched by that has to go with this a bit. Do we dare to take our children by the hand and walk them through the scriptures and simultaneously walk into our world? They may ask why we let injustice persist in our communities. They may ask why we teach one way but then live another. Peacemaking is not an activity of those on some strange fringe of the church. It is a vision that fulfills the scripture and the witness of the saints and martyrs all around us. Might we dare to teach our children how to risk everything for this pearl, this coin, this treasure, this vision, this gift. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. So the offering place for me for this children's lesson becomes that that shaping of the future of the church, shaping for the days beyond, and so that's really a piece of what goes on there. And so what we do during the children's lesson, from my perspective, is we introduce them to the cross, but not just that. As you all know, kids aren't the only ones who listen to the children's lesson. So in many ways, we're introducing the kids to the cross with the parents looking on and the other people in the congregation looking on and hearing what's happening in that message also. The utilitarian reason for putting it in the offering is that we're doing two things simultaneously. Kind of like when we're sometimes in liturgy, we'll sing and it'll cover the movement of the people up front, the leaders moving from one place to another, or moving out for the gospel procession. It covers movement. It's when we sing, oftentimes, if we forgot something up front, it's the time I'll lean over to the acolyte and say, "Go back to the narthex, stop, blah, 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 get this." And they'll go, it'll cover their action, and they scoot out around the side and do whatever needs to be done. So in this time of the offering, we've got the offering being collected, and what was going on when the offering was being collected before, we were pretty much watching the offering being collected, or watching the activity. There was a dead space, or there was music. Don't have anything against music, but if you're not gifted with someone who can play well during that time, oftentimes the offering went on and on and on, beyond the collection of the offering, and it wasn't always, you could see in the people's faces, it wasn't often the most creative thing going on. So the other piece that happens then is we've got that activity now going up front where people can still be putting money in the plate, the offering's taking place, but at the same time, there's a word happening up front. A couple of the spin-offs to all this has been, I mentioned the other day that I had this guy called Jason who helps me with all the children's lessons. But the interesting piece is where that I've grown, the teaching staff has grown. I think I've got about 10 of these people right now who take part in the children's lessons, which allows me to do a lot of different things with a lot more of the kids. And the funny thing is, some of them have come to me from kids. A couple weeks ago, one of the little kids in the congregation gave me a note at the beginning of the service, and she said, read this, so I read it, and it says, I have something for you later. Later, she came up to me with this rainbow-colored troll, and it was carrying a cross, and I got one of those. But oftentimes, it's adults who pick them up and bring them to me to use because they're listening to the sermons. And that's been kind of a neat spin-off to hear adults saying it. But the interesting thing about the adults saying, commenting about the children's lessons at that time, is that some folks have said that that's really tied in for them, made the whole purpose of the feast much more meaningful. Some folks will say it's the children's sermon. They like the children's sermon for that day. I mean, they'll say that about the regular sermon too, but the children's sermon is something that they'll vibrate with through the whole week. Maybe because the message is pretty ordinary and common and pretty extraordinary at the same time, but it's a connecting point. That's just been a spin-off no one has anticipated because we were supposed to be focusing mainly on those children. What I'd like to do is throw up four different categories that I kind of use just as a guideline for children's lessons and deal with that a little bit. One topic is simply this. It's what I call the can't touch this. It's those topics we usually don't talk about in the church. And so one of the topics I like to deal with Our issues we don't often play with. We don't talk about it. One of them, for example, is death in the congregation. A lot of times we pray for those folks. We've got people in our congregation like you might that have been sick for a long time and then they die. Or there's someone. Last fall we had a young woman went through hospice very quickly, died at age 45. And everybody knew about it, and it was really kind of devastating to a lot of folk. And using the children's sermon to deal with the death, issues that you can't touch. Another one that I've done before in kind of an indirect way is the whole issue of school prayer. I'll deal with that in a little bit. Another main topic is we're the church. This probably is the one where I use most of the children's lessons. And this is who's welcome here. Who can be a part of who we are? We live in a neighborhood that's very well racially mixed, and yet our congregation isn't. It doesn't reflect the neighborhood. And so we do a lot of talking about who's welcome into the congregation. And so a lot of the activities has to do with that. So I'll set up some of Jason's friends over here over against others, and we'll literally have discussions about who can be here. And it's mainly in our congregation, the way I use these characters is they do the talking. They're involved in it. They've seen something happen on the playground. They saw something happening just outside in the parking lot. Let me tell you about it. Or they'll come rushing in telling me that. When I mean they rush in, I literally go get them. And we'll run from like the baptismal pond in to where the kids are, so it's animated. So that the kids get caught up in, oh my gosh, he's been hurt, or he's been excluded, or they're not welcome, or this one's not. And so that gets to be a piece of this. It's defining who we are. One of the things I put down here was, and I'll have you do this in a bit, I like to use the parables of grace kind of as my guideline on this. The prodigal son, the woman who finds the lost coin, those kind of things to emphasize the importance of who we are. The third one, I was going to put as ethics, but I guess the other way I look at it is walk in the talk. And that's as simple as how do we live out there? One of the things I did one Sunday was sometimes I'll have these guys in my pants or my robe pockets and that. And one Sunday I just told the kids that. Did I get them this morning? I said, unbelievable. I was going to Big Bear and I was getting ready to cross the street to get the apple so that we can come here, we can chop it up, we have apple for communion. And It was real early in the morning. I get up about 5:30 in the morning on Sunday morning. It was real early in the morning. And I was standing by the light, and the light was red. No cars. So I started across the street, and I got to the other side of the street, and all of a sudden, bing! And I go into a little bit, Jason yelling at me for crossing the street when the light was red. Getting into a discussion then about do you need to obey laws or rules if nobody's going to see you disobeying them? And talk about what does it mean to walk the talk? What does it mean to say we're this kind of people and yet we try to sneak around and do things outside of the ordinary? That might be something walking the talk does. Has to do with ethics. Has to do with why there are rules at times. Why we do the things we do. The fourth category, let me make sure I get this, is the one I use a lot, John. It probably has to do with the seasons that you mentioned before, but simply dealing with what does this mean? And it has to do a lot with what's going on in the liturgy, pieces of the liturgical stuff in the worship space, but also some of the actions in the worship space. Talking about, I'll have my little friends here ask me, why in the world, every time I'm right in the middle of the Eucharistic part of the liturgy, do I bow down? And everybody sees just the top of my head until we're done singing. And that's usually at the time of the Sanctus I bend during that. So I'll use that as a time to explain why I bow and where the language comes from, and the vision of Isaiah and Revelation. So it'll have a biblical piece to try to help explain a piece of what's going on in the liturgy. The other part I use for this quite often is to help shatter some of the adiaphora that's going on in the church. Eternal candles, for example. We always have, I don't know if you do, we've got the candle up front in this red kind of glass case, and it's always burning, and kids will ask me, why is that on? Why is that always lit? And so we'll deal with that and blow it out, which all of a sudden devastates a lot of people when you blow out the eternal candle on a Sunday morning. But to help them see that that's not essential to who we are, and use it as a time to, again, get back on this whole track of who we are and who we're called to be and what that means for us. We've got 10 minutes. And what I'd like to do with that time is we don't have a big group here, but let's do this. If you would, get together with a few people and just very shortly want you to do a couple things. Think of us being a people who are involved in creating a contrast society. I mentioned that the first day. That we are a people that are setting up and involved in a whole new way of being people in this strange vision of the reign of God and following the crucified Lord along the way. That's who we are, and that's what we want our children to be. With that in mind, what I want you to do is, in any one of these four areas, if you could come up with a couple things that you think would be topics that our kids should be dealing with in children's lessons. So if you, for example, if you want to deal with this whole area, you can't touch this. What are some things that if we're trying to shape and we're trying to make our children into a people, we're trying to say this is who we are, what should we be dealing with? There. What might we be dealing with in regard to daily ethics, walking the talk, for kids? What could we be dealing with there? Again, with the We Are the Church and things in the liturgy, stuff in your congregation that you in some ways might need to turn around. This morning, Pete mentioned that in one congregation, the pastor had moved the Bible from one place and put it another place, and what did he say? They went from so many, couple hundred, or 1,600 members down to 390-some members, that was a kind of a breakthrough issue that took place. What would you want to share with the children? Maybe just take a few moments to do that. If you turn like just a few folks. Quickly get that. And if you want, maybe even talk about how would you do it? How would you do it?
And then sure. We I guess we ought to have two. What, three or four people?
Yeah, three or four people can be plenty. Yeah.
It would be nice to have a children broker on the baptismal front there and explain
with the parents' permission,
so they can see
and know what's going on.
And we've got a few kids in our house.
This is done now. It's no longer something that they ask the parents if it's okay. They just do it. Those two have no good chance to go out and look back at us and
say, either what part of the church you're in or what part of the
church you're in. Well, I think that's
one of those. Touched it, one of them we found out
I have never been using it. And then bringing it down and showing the children that it's a candle and then you can blow it out. And then it's a symbol. It isn't necessary for a faith. It's a symbol, one of the things that are in this church. And I thought that was very good. I mean, you could probably take it home. I think it's okay for the pastor to be in the front and say, maybe you can entitle it, talking to the children about the stranger.
I'm going to bring you back in if I could.
That's excellent.
You know, one of the things I didn't even mention to you as you turned away was when children's lesson takes place, I don't know about in your congregation, but we run the gamut from like the toddlers who can just make it up to the front all the way up to fifth grade or so. It's one of those things where educationally it's horrible. Because you can't always hit all the kids. Not all the kids are going to understand the message. But it's almost funny sometimes to hear what the kids thought the message was for the day. And parents will share that with me later. But I think one of the important things is that that gesturing, even that community involvement for the ones who aren't catching the message completely, is important. And the job I think for a pastor or whoever does it is that at least the language is. I think that's why I use these characters. It makes me talk, not like a little baby, but it makes me use language that the kids use a lot.
How long is your sermonette?
45 minutes. No. No.
it's
it just
long.
Seems that long.
It's as long as it takes, pretty much, for the offering to be collected. Sometimes it goes over.
You know, I've never timed it.
Yeah,
a couple minutes.
A couple minutes.
Yeah.
Now, if your pastor was uncomfortable doing it, who would you think of doing it for you?
Whoever can do that. There are loads of, we've got a couple women in our congregation. We'll share them with occasionally. I just like doing them, so I do them. But they're, I would think whoever can communicate with the kids and can allow them to feel that, let them feel welcome. That's really important piece.
Just a practical thought. Doesn't it take more than 2 minutes to get the kids up there and get them back? How do you work back?
In the middle of a piece, I'll already start saying, if kids want to come forward for the children's lesson, so they're already. In fact, what I find most often is we're sharing the piece and the kids are already trying to come forward. And they're shaking on the way up.
Part of your church service, and it seems to me the more you did it, the quicker the children respond, the actually less time.
It's become an excitement place, which has been, for them, which has been really a positive. What are some topics? Yeah.
I wanted to give you a personal note. At Lake Chelan Lutheran, my little granddaughter, who was two, never came forward until I was the interim pastor. Then she came forward and sat in my lap, and the other kids were fine with that because I was her grandpa. And the first time the new pastor came was a woman, and Mari went up and didn't know what to do. And the other kids said to the pastor, "She wants to sit in your lap." So the pastor picked her up, put her in line. So
great.
It was a great move that the kids made.
What about some topics, things that we could put up here?
I just at the end, I said one of the ones I thought went well, and it was Community of St. Martin without a typical children's sermon, but we talked with the kids about the shootings in the neighborhood and guns, and they really were tuned in. So it was both walking the talk about nonviolence, but it was also can't touch this.
Yeah.
They were right there.
Yep.
This is a very easy one to relate to, but I think doing a baptism for the children, having them come up. One of the girls, one of the ladies in our interview said that she asked this little boy if he'd ever seen a baptism. He said, "No, little pastor, you've been here many years." He said, "Well, I've never seen one." So that maybe there wouldn't be an objection to actually using a baby doll and having the children gather around where they can really see it.
See, I would bring them forward for an actual baptism so they could see.
On a regular basis, they wait for the children to come up, which is a very good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things that Eric does when there's a baptism, it's kind of like, I don't care where I'm sitting, I'm going to get up there. I'm going to see this, and you're not going to stop me. Thank you very much. This is important to me, and he sees that. But one of the things that I've observed with Eric when he was smaller and we grew up in the children's time is, what do you do with a disruptive child that doesn't get it? And Eric is hyperactive, and he'll frequently make comments that aren't on target, but he'll also make comments sometimes that are just right there.
Yeah.
And how do you sit through that? And what I have seen different people do with grace and understanding is to be able to be open to hearing not the words, but maybe the message that he's trying to get. And when he gets way off, say, "Okay, we can talk about that later. Let's talk about this over here." But it acknowledges that that's an okay thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this here.
Exactly.
And then to bring it around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things, and I'll... let me deal with that one first. One of the things that, a quote from Gerhard Loefling that for me has just been marvelous. Peace spreads through fascination, not through compulsion or even teaching. And one of the things one of the ways I see this children's lesson is, it's a time of fascination. When Peter this morning was talking about the brain and the ability to imagine, it's a place of imagination, fascination. And so one of the things I work on a lot is to make it that kind of a time where the kids are literally caught up in the activity of the story. And so we will get comments like that. And most time, if they're way out here or way out there, it's pretty easy to do what you just said, to acknowledge and accept and welcome and play right back into the fascination.